First, thanks to Perry Hoffman, Trish Woodward and others for organising and inviting me again to the NEABPD conference. I'm sharing this with Mary, but I don't know now, Mary, I can keep up with the US developments, but I'll try. Let me put this in context as well for the UK, that the UK started off later than your guidelines, actually, but in 2003, when the government suddenly learned, which was a big surprise to them but not to anyone else, that people with personality disorder were actually generally stigmatized, were not admitted to hospital when they may need it, and were thrown out of emergency rooms when they had taken an overdose without further follow-up and so on. This was no surprise to anybody except the government, as far as I could see. But they got upset, not so much because of that, but because, in fact, because a man with antisocial personality disorder had been rejected from an inpatient psychiatric unit and then committed a heinous crime of murder, or at least he was found guilty of it. So they asked the question about what's happening to these patients, as if the whole thing was new. And then they discovered, of course, the answer was not very much with regard to mental health and social services. So they set up a group which I was part of, and we came up with a document which was the first document to focus on personality disorder overall, which was called Personality Disorder, No Longer a Diagnosis of Exclusion, and that was published in 2003. That led to 2004, to the government actually being told, well, if they wanted something to be done, then they need to give some money. Governments like things to be done, but they don't like giving money. But they did actually give £11 million, believe it or not, allegedly. Because we could never really fully find the £11 million, but we did find some of it. And they gave this money to actually develop some community-based services, was the plan, and I'll show that to you in a minute. The problem with the UK government, it says it's giving money and then says, well, really, we already gave it, so you've got to find it from your current budgets. That's their trick. So we found some, but certainly not 11 million. So that was the second development. And then the third development was the National Institute for Clinical Excellence producing a guideline for borderline personality disorder and its treatment and management, and that's currently on consultation on a website. It's not fully published yet. So what happened to the alleged 11 million, which was probably about 6 million, but there were a number of services set up around the country, and you can see that this is a sort of map of Little England, Scotland, and Wales, but it was, and you can see that it was England, in fact, because that's where the money was given. Scotland had separate money. And you can see that assessment was primarily made on geography rather than anything else. Evidence didn't really come into it much, and they just sprinkled a little bit of money and hoped it went to different areas in the country. So you can see it's a nice little map around the place. Okay, so I've grown cynical, but nevertheless, they were very, 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 they're very good services, and they were set up around. But you can see that what was interesting was most of the services that were put forward and made a bid for the money were not based on treatment models, i.e. DBT or anything else. They were based on actual service organizations and contexts of treatment, outpatient, user groups, or day hospitals, and so on. They were establishing services within current treatment systems. So those were set up. We bid, primarily Mike Crawford was the lead in this, for money to actually research those new services. So we got the money for that, and some of that data is now being published. This is the first one in the British Journal of Psychiatry, which was a sort of Delphi study of expert consensus and users trying to find out from users, from service providers, managers and others, and senior clinicians what they thought about certain aspects of the treatment of personality disorder, but in particular borderline personality disorder. As you can imagine, experts didn't quite agree with patients, and patients didn't quite agree with managers, and managers didn't agree with anybody, and so on. But we gradually did a whole Delphi study to try to get a consensus about what the key components were for treatment of patients with borderline personality disorder and other ones. That's being published, as I say, in the British Journal of Psychiatry this month, and there's another paper coming out in the Acta Psychiatric Scandinavica in the next few months on the same process. But this was an evaluation of the 11 pilot sites, and hopefully to make further recommendations about the treatment and future services for patients with personality disorder. So there was a whole organizational evaluation. You see, we have a different problem from you, but I think it's significant in the treatment of borderline personality disorder. You have a treatment problem that Mary's just outlined in terms of insurance and 40 million people uninsured and so on. We don't quite have that problem, but we do have a problem of penetration of treatment and services within the way our services are organized. It's just, in other words, you have a problem of penetration because of insurance. We have a problem of penetration because of systems and organization of services. So patients can't access services for various reasons. And patients with personality disorder have been shown to have less access to services in the UK than other patients in the services. So we did an organizational evaluation. We tried to look at levels of activity and the functioning of the levels of function of people who actually referred to the services. And we had a service quality component to have a look at the perspective of the service user and the Delphi survey that I've mentioned. So what were the key findings? There's a whole document on this, and that will be published on a website so people can read the whole study. But how services were delivered appeared to be much more important to both service users and to the staff in general than actually what was being delivered. Now, that sounds very odd. But patients actually, for example, the qualitative data and some of the basic quantitative data from a Sun project, which was a service user network project, didn't offer treatment. It actually offered the facilities and the ability for service users within specific areas to meet. So all patients with personality disorder had their meetings facilitated by a mental health professional. And then they could do what they like, I suppose, but it wasn't quite like that. But they met and they had discussions about how to access services, how to manage certain problems they were all facing, and so on. And the outcomes and the satisfaction ratings from that were just as good as from some of the more formalized treatment intervention services. Right? So service delivery and actually is very important. Right? It looked like you needed a range of options. Some patients needed more intensive work, some less intensive, and that didn't surprise anyone. But it was very clear from all the data that we got that actually the impact on staff and the importance of staff function was of significant levels of importance in the whole service delivery. Right? Let me give you an example. In one service, all the staff within 6 months, not all, actually 90%, there was one person left. The rest had gone off sick or actually left. Now, that was a problem not of the patients, but actually of the team function and how they managed and how they got on together and the levels of supervision probably. But overall, the service user experience throughout all 11 sites was highly positive. So it didn't matter, as I say, what treatment, but as Mary said, paraphrasing me, reasonable people delivering something reasonably with some enthusiasm in a structured way does wonders when compared to normal treatment. Okay. So that was two slides for £11 million worth of... fantastic. Well, if they'd given us 20 million, you'd get four slides. But it is all summarized in quite a long document that will be published on the web. Okay, what about the current development, though, which is the National Institute of Clinical Excellence and their guidance for the management of borderline personality disorder? This is of much more significance and likely to be of much more influence and importance in the UK than any of the previous work. I put the website there for you. You can go there and the full document is available, because it's out for consultation and you can read it all. It's very, very long, but there is an executive summary. All right? It's still in draft. I was on the guidance development group, the GDG so-called, but anything I say has to be taken as just being my current view. It's nothing to do with the NICE view, so I will comment on it because the official guidance will not be formalized until Christmas. Okay, so this is draft information. It could all change. But why did they decide to do it? Well, because as you all know, the prevalence of borderline personality disorder is actually relatively high as a mental illness problem. It's very high when you look in psychiatry, inpatient groups and so on. It is more diagnosed in women within services and so on, but as Mary said, that varies actually depending on where you look. But certainly in the prison population it's higher, and it's higher in men and so on. So we've got a lot of patients who are being considered for treatment for borderline personality disorder, and they're actually high users of services. The second highest to patients with schizophrenia. Patients with borderline personality disorder use services a lot. For example, emergency services, A&E services, emergency rooms, and so on. It's known that they have morbidity levels. I don't think they're as high as they're reported in the literature, and Mary's just suggested that in her longitudinal follow-up study. But they do also have marked social and interpersonal functioning problems, which, as Mary said, appears to be a whole area of which our treatments are relatively ineffective. So they're a big problem. The acute symptoms tend to be reduced relatively quickly, and I'll come back to that, but the some of the longer-term problems of social and interpersonal relationships tend to remain, and we're not very good at targeting those in treatment. But we also know there's huge comorbidity, i.e. coexisting problems such as substance misuse, eating disorders, and so on. So it's a very important area. NICE has to decide on its scope, and it puts out the scope of the work to public consultation. So you have to decide, for example, are you going to include people less than 18 or only people 18 to 65, people over 65, and all these sorts of things. And I can assure you, whatever you decide, that some group write to you and say, why were we excluded? That seems to be the case normally, and you never even meant to exclude them. But this is very important because they're then brought in to the scope if it's appropriate. So it was actually adults aged 18 and older, going on forever. So the old age people wrote and said we didn't have enough on old age and things like that. Probably didn't, but there's not a lot of research of borderline personality disorder in old age. Younger people below 18 years were included, and I'll come back to that, and people with learning disability were also included if they had borderline personality disorder. Okay. You have to scope the settings where, and so we're looking across all main health service settings in the UK. Okay, so outpatients, inpatients, day patients, more secure settings, and then the interface of those settings, because that's often a problem, that patients with personality disorder in one setting and then are transferred to another setting for some reason and their treatment is completely removed and there's no continuity at all. And so on. And that's particularly true, as it happens, from the interface between childhood and adult services in the UK, that I have to regularly now go to adolescent units where somebody's been for 3 years, 4 years, and they suddenly write a letter as if they've just noticed that next month they're going to be 18. And because they're 18, guess what? They're grown up. And so they're adult. Okay. And it's a big problem, that interface of transfer. So those were the scopes, the treatments, though, were really those treatments that were available in the NHS, which I'll come back to in a minute, but included pharmacological interventions and psychological interventions, as well as identification. But we also included in the scope common clinical problems, such as the management of comorbidities, as far as they may influence the treatment of borderline personality disorder, the role of families and carers, and I think I emailed Trish, I think, and asked for the NEABPD for evidence about the role of families and carers. We tried to get as much qualitative data as well as quantitative data as we could to sift through it to try to work out what recommendations we could or couldn't make and what the level of evidence was for that. Oh, we did consider alternative sort of complementary phenomena, because there are a lot of pressure groups around, and you know, we didn't want to miss out on anything particularly. So we get people writing in saying, you know, have we considered the use of acupuncture, art therapy? It doesn't matter, lots and lots. So we did include that within the scope. Okay, we did not cover treatments not normally available. Okay, and we did not cover the separate management, i.e. of, say, depression or something, outside the context of borderline personality disorder. So I gave you a slide of the summary of all this scope, and within the documentation that you can read on the web, you will see that we've made some recommendations or not, as it were, under each heading. Okay. So what's the general sense of key priorities? Well, you'll see that the first one is services. Now, I would like to make a case the problem at the moment, for not just in the UK, is actually to do with provision of services, how people access them and how they get them. You can't access them partly because of insurance. Our patients can't access them because actually they don't get referred. They're seen as a nuisance. They're stigmatized. They're kept out in various ways. And they have so many hurdles to get through that, in fact, they can't actually get to treatment with some specialist input. It's a big problem. The second thing is that once you get into services is the levels of training, the levels of knowledge of the actual staff that are then going to be treating the person with borderline personality disorder. They don't have the skills, they don't feel they have the skills, and so on. So you get, again, a problem because people tend to avoid such patients, particularly if they're high risk or if they're rather difficult or if they write letters of complaint or all sorts of things, okay, that go on. So we've made suggestions about provision of service. The first thing is about access, which of course is obvious. Right? But the importance of this, it becomes a national government guidance, government-supported guidance for services. You have to show that actually you're not keeping people out. Right? The second statement was about autonomy and choice. There's a problem about choice because if there's nothing, there's not really a lot of choice. But you should be able to help the patient develop some autonomy, some responsibility, self-responsibility, and hope that they remain active. And we've listed out many of these aspects that we would expect services to actually offer, okay, in terms of clear pathways for people with personality disorder. So you can set up a system so that, in fact, we monitor this nationwide. You can actually ask about the flow of people with personality disorder, particularly borderline personality, through the systems, and you'll be able to see whether they actually are moving in and if they're different from area to area. So you can probably pick out areas that are not offering services appropriately. Right? Staff attitudes are important, and these have to be led with some training and so on, and we put... Again, you'd say this is obvious, but developing an optimistic and trusting relationship. Okay. It's easier written than it is actually done within services, as you can imagine. But nevertheless, these are the sorts of ideas that you will think are a bit soft, but are being put in some of the guidance. Okay. Managing endings and transitions. We know that patients with borderline personality disorder are actually very sensitive to endings, transitions, to movements, to therapists leaving. We know in some evidence that the self-harm rate may go up when key personnel within a team leave for some reason within a treatment program and so on. So actually managing endings and transitions is an important area. And we describe to some extent how to do that. Right? We have such things as care plans. Every patient should have a care plan, and that care plan needs to identify clear roles and responsibilities between the psychiatrist, say, and the therapist, for example, between the social worker and the employment support worker, something like this. We have, because many of our patients in the UK have two or three people involved in their treatment in some way once they've entered services. OK, Okay? And we're concerned at the lack of coordination of care between those people. So every patient must have a care plan. Okay? And that has to be agreed by the patient and by the carers, and that they have to agree that. That would include the families, and we've put that specifically in the guidance at the moment. We discussed it in depth, not because of confidentiality issues, but some of our users within the guideline group recognized that some of the patients didn't actually want their parents in there, and things like this. So you actually have to get them signed up to the process. Okay. And one final thing that should be in is crisis plans. Just to tell you, all over 10 years, I was most upset to find in our research data that when we ask patients qualitatively what they feel helps them with their treatment, I was always hoping that they would say something which was very specific about our treatment program, which is called mentalizing. So I'd hope that they say, oh, we're learning to mentalize or something, you know, would be the thing. Nothing to do with it whatsoever. And they didn't really care about that. That was something we cared about. But what they did care about was the fact that they had a proper crisis plan. Very interesting. That was it. That was the main thing they thought was helpful. There were two things. One was being taken seriously, and the other was actually, well, they knew what to do in a crisis. Okay? Interesting, I think. What about psychological treatments? We've not named at the moment, but this is, again, I'm just summarizing what's already on the website. We've not named any specific treatment. We don't think there's adequate evidence. But we do think there's suggestive evidence that therapy is best provided in at least two modalities at the same time, to some extent. This may go by December, by the way, because there's consultation. We have a lot of people who actually write in and tell us what we've written is nonsense. So there are two modalities, usually individual and group. I keep worrying that's me, but it's not. therapy is best provided in two modalities, individual and group, and across the range of psychological treatments, there's some suggestion that may be helpful. But certainly treatment should be offered in a well-structured program within a coherent theory of practice and actually include supervision within its framework. We don't think in general for patients who've got severe problems with their borderline personality disorder that therapists should generally be just left alone. But that's our view. But when left alone, they get in trouble, as does the patient. So brief psychotherapeutic interventions, there's very limited evidence. What about medication? We're a bit harsher about medication. Psychological treatment should not be routinely offered for borderline personality disorder itself, the actual disorder. There's no evidence. But when you look at comorbid disorders, you may use medication for a specific comorbid disorder. But when you do, we make some recommendations. You should consider that medication within the overall framework of treatment, okay, not just on its own. Identify key roles of the prescriber in relation to other people involved in the care, and that you should be highly reflective in this group of patients about prescribing. For example, not prescribing as a sort of way of signifying care or managing one's own anxiety and so on. As Mary said, we tend to think we have to do something, so we give it. We're a psychiatrist or a prescriber, we give medication and so on, and we think that's more common possibly in this group of patient psychiatrist interactions than others, so you have to be aware. So there's lots of knots in our prescribing guidance at the present time. We don't think there's adequate evidence for medication at all. But we've also finally made some suggestions about assessments and treatment planning so that patients will actually have formal assessments, formal treatment planning, care planning, and then suggested psychological and prescribing guidance. And these will be enshrined then within care pathways within the UK services. Okay, so we've said that. But finally, we said that they should all have crisis plans. You can see I was on the guidance, can't you? See, I thought they've got to have a crisis plan. And that people should consult the crisis plan. Right? So that when they turn up at the emergency room or at the emergency assessment center for mental health, that somebody bothers to look at the crisis plan. You know, it's all right having one, but somebody's got to look at it. And they don't look at it. And what was happening in some data that we had was that actually they weren't looking at it and they were circumventing the crisis plan, which again was undermining the overall treatment and the development of the help to the patient. So we listed out a series of suggestions about management of crises and crisis plans. And we also suggested you're very, very wary about starting medication use during a crisis. A lot of them are started during a crisis, and then instead of being short adjunctive treatments, they actually become long-term medication treatments, unwittingly, really, because they're started in a crisis and they simply continue. Okay. So what's the future here? Well, the future, as you'll see, is there's no more funding. All right? The government has said there's no more money. You'd wonder where the 210 billion or the 50 billion in the UK suddenly appeared for the City of London, but it didn't appear for borderline personality disorder. There's just no money. They've said there's no more money, and that's the end of it. All right? But there will be pressure on hospitals to improve and implement treatments in the way that the NICE guidance has outlined, and those will be monitored by a central monitoring system. So there is pressure in the system, which is what we want. But you have to mobilize pressure groups as much as possible, develop family networks and support, and we've put in for a grant to try to do that, and of course develop further research programs. So those are the ideas for the future. So there are things happening in the UK, and we hope that it will improve the lot of people with borderline personality disorder. So thanks very much. Many patients with borderline personality disorder become professional patients, gaining admission repeatedly by pulling their trump card by saying, I'm suicidal. How does the ER dare not admit them? Yeah, over and over. Yeah, this is a major problem. We'd hope that the crisis plans would allow that to be reduced if the ER, we in fact, our patients tend to go to local ERs, so they in fact will have crisis plans, and they'll be able, for each patient that's known to present in this way, and they will have to implement that crisis plan and so on. But the other way is to actually admit people overnight and then have them seen within the treatment team the following day. So there's rapid access to the treatment team, which is in the crisis plans. So we tend to try to integrate the system, which seems to prevent admissions, at least long-term admission. Because once people go in, they tend to get their stay in for longer than necessary, which might be not so helpful. Do you have any suggestions for work of someone who has borderline personality disorder, a factitious disorder? I don't have any suggestions for work, but I should say that people with borderline personality disorder are excellent in some areas. One area that many of our patients have become involved is actually involved in some sort of role in which they're actually in a structured environment looking after others. So they're involved in systems, for example, in schools. We have not one or two patients who work within school systems doing some auxiliary teaching, some helping out and things like that. But I don't think I can suggest what type of work for people. How do you explain the diagnosis, the meaning of the term borderline personality disorder to the new patient after assessment? Yeah, we have a system of discussing the diagnosis with patients. We do this, in fact, through taking examples within their assessments and life history that may relate to the current descriptive criteria for borderline personality disorder. So, for example, relationship problems, and we look at those, and then we consider them in relation to how normal or how different they may be, their relationships to other relationships, affect storms, dysregulation, we go through that and consider that. We say, look, this is what that amounts to, and then they go off and read about it and so on. So that's probably how we do that. Are support groups for the users advisable? If so, with what degree of supervision? Well, this is a very interesting question. We were very concerned about the service user network. We saw this as one of those, this is going to sound terrible, I know it's on video, but one of those sort of politically correct phenomena where a group of people with personality disorder get together, and how do they actually, how do you support that, what levels of supervision, and so on. In fact, they report very few problems overall. There's quite a lot of peer support that comes out of that group, but they do have two things. One is they have some member of the team there with all, in all the meetings, and they also, all the people within the groups actually have access to members in the project, so i.e. professional staff outside the groups. So that if they have a problem within the group, then they can see someone and discuss it, and so on. So there are reasonable boundaries maintained. Do you have a view about how the new DSM in 2011 should address borderline personality disorder? Oh, dear, dear, dear. I don't think they're bothered about my view. Can I just say no to that? I don't have a view. I think it's going to get very complicated about what happens to it, but I just hope that they don't lose the focus on personality and personality disorder. That, to me, is the issue. That focus should still remain so that the things are kept on the boil and in the public eye and in mental health professionals' eye. Why should meds not be used for individual symptoms, behaviours with borderline personality, particularly since some of them are so devastating? Yeah, this is very interesting. I mean, this is one of the divides, I'm afraid, I think, to some degree, between research evidence and clinical evidence. The clinicians tend to use medication for specific symptoms in borderline personality disorder, but we could find no evidence to suggest that medication was really very useful for any of the specific symptoms. For example, you might find that there was a little bit of evidence for a symptom of hostility. If someone's sensitive with that hostility, and maybe you should use drug X. But the evidence we found was so limited, I think the guidance will probably suggest it's not a wise course of action, so on. For clinicians, I think the other way around is that if you feel compelled to do this, and patients, of course, are highly distressed by some of these symptoms, you see. So it's not just the bad prescribing or something. There's a sort of issue here about how you help the person feel actually somewhat little less distressed so that they can function just marginally better, which makes a big difference. Is that if you do, I think the issue to prescribe under those circumstances is you make sure it's very short term indeed, basically, if you can, between you. Between you and the individual, you make sure it's a week or something, and then there's a careful review of everything, and do it like that. How do you explain to the family you love who think you're a hypochondriac, a manipulator, and drama queen? Well, I think this is related to education, support for families, and for them to, as it were, begin to reframe things, because increased understanding and knowledge usually allows you to do that. So I think this is an issue. We all feel manipulated at certain times. You have to have a capacity to begin to realize that that may not be the motive of that person, even if you think it is. This is, of course, what we call mentalizing, but not, you know, your understanding of someone else's motive in relation to you and yours in relation to them is what mentalizing is, and it's really hard to do when you start saying, well, somebody's just doing that deliberately. And professionals do it, let alone families. Professionals say, well, you know, she just tried to kill herself to get back at me, or something, things like this. Yeah, I don't think so, you know. And so on. So I think that's to do with education and support, frankly. Okay.